yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. They brought death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to continue in part three of our series, which we called The Bomb, The Fuse, and The Dud. Today we'll talk about The Dud. What is The Dud? Well, you remember The Bomb? That was the Eurozone quantitative easing program that was introduced here several weeks ago in January. $1.3 trillion of liquidity going to be injected into the Eurozone economy by its central bank, European Central Bank. And that follows trillions already that has been injected by other programs like the LTRO, long-term refinancing option, and other programs since 2010. So another $1.3 trillion. All these central banks, you see, all over the world are pumping in all this free money, liquidity. QE, what is that? That's where the government buys up the bonds, puts cash in the hands of the businesses in the hope that they will then, with that cash, invest it, create jobs, and give a boost to the economy. Well, we're seeing all over the world that that policy just doesn't work. They put all the money in the hands, but it doesn't move from the hands of the corporations and the investors. They sit on it. You know, we're just getting details here for the U.S. that corporations are sitting on $3.5 trillion, U.S. corporations. You know, with maybe half of that stuffed in offshore tax shelters. $3.5 trillion and not investing it. You can put all the money in their hands, but that doesn't mean they're going to do anything with it that you want them to. What do they do with it? Oh, well, other than sit on it, they give dividends back, or they buy back their stock. Last year, $700 billion in stock buybacks in the U.S., plus hundreds of billions more in dividend increase payouts. You know, so they're giving it to their rich capitalist investors is what they're doing. And the part that they don't give to them, they sit on it. You know, that $3.5 trillion is after the stock buybacks, after the dividend payouts, after investing offshore, perhaps, although that's come down to pretty much of a stop or slowing rapidly. They were doing that in emerging markets. Or what they do is invest in financial securities that doesn't create any job. They speculate, buy foreign exchange, you know, buy bonds of this company or that country, or you know, invest in properties and invest in stocks and so forth all over the world. So that's what they do with all that cash that the central banks are pumping into them. They're sitting on it, and what they're not sitting on, they're paying out to their rich investors, or, you know, or they're speculating themselves. And that's why we see capital spending and investment, real investment that would create real jobs, slowing. And this has been going on for quite some time, at least 15 years, this slowdown, this global slowdown. And it's one of the topics I focus on in my new forthcoming book by Clarity Press here in a couple months, which is called Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy. We'll talk more about that. But anyway, QE, you know, central bank, QE, pumping money. And that's what the Eurozone ECB did. Pumped another $1.3 trillion. Well, with that same silly argument that doesn't work, that they're going to then spend it to create jobs. No, that's not what's happening anymore. You know, and economic mainstream economists, they're still saying that, oh, you know, if you reduce corporate costs, they're going to invest. Nah, they're not going to invest. They're not investing. Just look at the reality, Mr. Mainstream Economist. You know, stop thinking of your silly theories that don't work anymore and look at what's actually happening. Capitalism in the 21st century has dramatically changed, fundamentally changed. Its financial structure and its labor market structure and other structures have fundamentally changed. But these economists are still looking at theories that they wrote in the 60s and 70s, or maybe 80s if they're monetarists. None of them work. Neither wing of mainstream economics works anymore. You know, I call them hybrid Keynesians and retro-classicalists. Oh, I got a chapter of that in my book as well. So, QE, the bomb. And why is it a bomb? You know, why shouldn't that be the dud? Because nothing's happening. No, it's a bomb because what it's done is set off global currency wars. Now, it's one thing when Japan introduces QE, massive QE, in 2013, which, by the way, didn't do anything for their economy either. You know, they got about a 70% boost in the stock markets, and corporations, you know, drove down the currency. Corporations increased their export sales. They did better. But then it all came to a halt after about 9 months. And Japan went right into another recession. Oh, well, watch Japan to do another round of this stuff. You know, because after all, the U.S. did three rounds of QE. And effectively, the Eurozone has, well, UK did a QE, and Eurozone now is doing its QE. And other countries will follow suit. But it's not only that it set off a currency war. And if you look at it, it really has. Currencies everywhere. You know, the euro is dropping in relationship to the dollar and in relationship to a basket of other goods, currency goods. But other countries are now doing the same, trying to stimulate and reduce their currencies by other money manipulation means in response. And then you got this other problem. For example, in the Eurozone, now, in response to Eurozone QE, what's happened? Well, more and more countries in the European Union are lowering their interest rates so low that they're negative. In other words, in countries like Switzerland and Denmark and Sweden now, all within recent weeks, you put your money in the bank, you got to pay the bank to take your money. Yeah, if you leave your money in the bank, you got to pay the bank. Well, that shows how desperate they are to get businesses to invest. By having a negative interest rate in the banking system, that means you got to pay the bank to leave your money there. So presumably, theoretically, you're not going to leave your money there. You're going to use it to invest. And that's the argument of negative banks. And also, it's designed to stop the flow of money into Switzerland, Denmark, Sweden, and create a nice situation for foreign exchange speculators. You know, drive up the cost or the value of those currencies, and what you get is foreign currency speculators, hedge funds, equity funds, all that stuff, shadow banks, jumping in and driving up the price to make a profit here, speculative profit, and then selling the currency. But that drives up the currency even further than ordinarily would happen. So to stop the speculation in their currencies, Switzerland, Denmark, now Sweden yesterday, have imposed this negative interest rates. Right? We'll see whether that stops the speculators or not. I doubt it. But what it will do, of course, presumably, is stimulate investment. Well, investment in what, you see? Investment in what? In real goods and services that create real jobs and hire real people? Or in financial assets again? You see, this is one of the big changes in 21st century global capitalist economy, and that is there are so many opportunities for investing in financial securities. There's so many liquid financial asset markets, and it's safer because you can get in and out of these highly liquid markets much faster than you can in real investments. And the rate of return is so quick, you know, if it rises, of course. And the rate of return is so quick, and it's so much safer. You can get in and out, make your profits and everything. So you compare that to investing long-term in a company making something like Tesla Motors or something like that, you know, a company trying to create electric cars and buck the big auto companies. You know, that's a big risk. You don't know you're going to get your money out of that if you're an investor. But, you know, I can jump into the Forex market real quick, you know, make a killing because the dollar's going up, you know, or bet on the euro going down because of QE, and I can make just as much profit in weeks that it would take me years to make investing in Tesla. That's what's changed, you see. Some call that financialization. But nonetheless, economists don't understand finance, what's going on in 21st century, because they're still trained in these old approaches that don't look at financial variables. And they don't understand the relationships between financial cycles and real cycles. So they keep talking about half of the reality in the global economy. And you know what? Even Marxist economists are kind of befuddled by all this, because Marxist economists focus on the real side, you know, productive labor and the falling rate of profit and all that other stuff, right? Looking at the productive side, and the financial side is considered fetish capital, right? It's not determinative. It's derivative of the real side of the economy. In that sense, they're no different than mainstream economists who continue to focus on real variables and don't understand financial variables. Well, I'm going to talk about that too in my book. How neither mainstream and its two wings, the hybrid Keynesians, who aren't really Keynesians, you know, they call people Keynesians. They're not really Keynesians. No, they're hybrids. And they've been hybrids since, you know, late 1940s. You know, they integrate into their version of Keynes ideas that Keynes himself was fighting against, opposing. And they call themselves Keynesians. Well, they're not really Keynesians. They're hybrids. They're a little bit of this, a little bit of that. You know? And then, of course, the retro-classicalists, who are they? These are guys who want to go back even to 19th century, and they recast it. You know, they're good wordsmiths, and they recast those old burned-out theories that don't say anything. And, you know, and they pose it as an alternative. Monetarism is an alternative. Well, we see what monetarism does. I mean, we've pumped 20 trillion, 30 trillion, maybe, I don't know, we add up all the central banks since 2008 of liquidity, money into the economy, and that's supposed to stimulate growth, but it hasn't. You know, that whole relationship between the central bank's money injection and the stimulating in the economy, lowering interest rates, then stimulates the economy, that's totally broken down. It doesn't exist except in the minds of people, you know, economists who can't make the break to reality. That's the only place it exists. That's not the 21st century, in fact. So, you know, we got all this money injection going on and setting up currency wars and not having an effect leading to negative interest rates. No one knows how much that's going to precipitate more instability in the financial systems and the global economy. No one knows that yet, you know, but they're stumbling from, they're like drunks walking down the hallway, bouncing off walls. And that's what they're doing, trying whatever they can and making sure whatever they try is in the interest of the people who they really represent, which are the wealthy investors. Okay, so that's the bomb. What's the fuse? Well, we've been talking about the fuse the last couple of weeks. That's the Greek debt negotiations. That's the fuse. You know, I mean, the metaphor, the fuse, means it could really go off, couldn't it? the fuse. Greek austerity and debt negotiations. The new party come into government power in Greece, Syriza, it's called, right? And after 5 years of depression, Greek people have had it. No more. We're not going to be, ball and chain to the European Troika. The Troika. What's the Troika? The Troika is, of course, the European Commission. Eurozone-wide bureaucrats. European Commission. They're really bankers. And the ECB, European Central Bank, and the IMF, International Monetary Fund. That's the Troika. And they're the ones who have indebted Greece. As I explained a couple of weeks ago, this whole indebted thing begins because you get the currency called the euro in 1999. And following that, it means you got like a common market there, all in Europe, continental Europe at least. And you can then have a currency that becomes the dominant currency. You don't have trade limits and so forth. Money can flow freely, totally freely. And then you get a economic powerhouse like Germany that makes a lot of goods, and Germany now can sell those goods to the periphery in Europe, the Spain, the Greece, and Ireland, and so on and so forth. And it does. Northern Europe sells all these goods. Well, how is the periphery in Southern Europe going to pay for it? Well, Northern Europe and their banks give them loans. And they fund those loans through the government and directly bank to bank. So you get all this demand, all this spending by the periphery buying Northern Europe goods, and Northern Europeans get their economies, and they get pretty rich out of that. So they're recycling their money through the periphery back to them, and then some. And in the meantime, the periphery gets in debt. And then we have the global crisis, and they can't pay the debt because the economies are slowed down. So they renegotiate the debt once again in 2010-12. And it's interesting because in the Eurozone, when they renegotiated the debt in 2012, what they did was restructure it so they paid off the private lenders, and the Troika took on the debt of the private lenders. Of course, debt was debt to the Greeks, whether it was private or this quasi-official government. But, they issued more debt to pay off the old debt, to make sure the old debt kept getting paid off. And that's the trap you can get in, you see. If you don't have real economic growth, you can't pay off the old debt, so they give you new debt. Well, you can't pay that off either without economic growth. And you don't have economic growth because the terms and conditions that accompany this debt and additional debt is austerity. And austerity means you're going to be locked into depression. So, it's kind of a contradiction, grand contradiction, this IMF, EU, ECB policy, Troika policies. But, it's a contradiction everywhere when you see this locked into debt, and therefore you got to cut your spending. Austerity means you got to sell off your public goods, sell off your public investments. And that's part of it. Then you got to raise taxes. That slows down, or collect more taxes. That slows down government. And then you got to lay off tens of thousands of people, government workers. And then you got to eliminate pensions, cut pensions, and cut social services if they're public social services like they are in Europe. So you're just ensuring that you're going to have a depression, and you can't pay it off if you got a depression, so you got to give you more debt, and it keeps going on and on and on. Well, the Greeks said, no more of this nonsense. We figured this one out. You Germans and Dutch can go to hell. We're not paying anymore, and we're going to stop this austerity. And, the latest discussions, of course, have been the Greeks saying austerity goes first. We're going to stop the austerity because that's a precondition for resolving anything here. And once we stop the austerity, then we renegotiate the debt. In other words, we'll pay off our debts to you, Troika, but only if our economy grows. So let's change out all these old bonds that you've got, the old debt, and let's create new GDP growth-related bonds, which means if we grow, we pay off a certain percent. If we don't grow, we don't pay off. Right? Or some have even proposed, although I don't think this is on the table with Greece, but some have proposed what they call perpetual bonds. What's that? Oh, okay, we get a bond that goes forever and ever, but you only pay interest. You never have to pay the principal off. That's another possible solution that's being bounced around. Yeah, I think, you know, Europe will go and the Troika will go for this GDP stuff. And the Greeks were saying, look, you know, you want us to just continue this deal, when the old deal, when it ends up on February 28th. We're not going to do that. We're not going to just roll over and continue the deal. You know, we're not going to continue that deal. And in the meantime, we want you to give back some of the money that you owe us, Troika, on the Greek bonds you have that have been earning interest since 2012. We want you to pay us that $2 or $3 billion, and we want some a short-term bridge loan of another, you know, €6-7 billion to hold us over while we negotiate with you on these GDP swaps, bond swaps. You know, swap the old bonds for GDP-related bonds. That's the Greeks' position. And, you know, a week or so ago, everything's moving so fast there, the Troika, led by the finance ministers, including the German finance minister, Wolfgang Schäuble, said, no, we're not doing that. Continue austerity. We're not going to give you any bridge loan. And, you know, Greece says, okay, well, you know, we're not changing our position. And if necessary, we'll leave the Eurozone. Greek exit. Ooh, that really shook up, you know, the money bags there, banker bags in Northern Europe, because if you Greece leaves the exit, well, $240 billion in debt, gone. Zippo. They're not going to walk away from that. They're not going to let Greece leave the Eurozone, you know. So they blinked. And the latest information that I have here is that they say, okay, we'll give you a 5 billion euro bridge loan. Not until June that you asked for. You know, Greeks asked for 10 billion and negotiate to June. We'll give you 5 billion and we'll negotiate for two more months, right? That's what they said. Now, the Greeks also, as a kind of a concession, a signal, said, we're going to go ahead with some of the privatization, some of the selling off of the assets in Greece. You know, that's what they really, one thing that the Northerners really want. They want to get in there and get those public assets privatized, get control of those public assets. Okay, so the Greeks said, you know, we're privatizing, selling off the port of Piraeus there, the main port, to private interest. That was part of the old austerity deal. And we had said all that was frozen, all these privatizations are frozen, but we'll let that go through. You can privatize the port. And who are they going to sell it to? They're going to sell it to the Chinese. Very clever of them. And, you know, it's not so important that they stop all privatizations. Don't get me wrong. What is important, for example, is not to privatize the electricity system, because that's really going to hit consumers. Prices will go up. They'll charge more. So certain privatizations aren't as bad as others. And very clearly, the Greeks are focusing on the importance of eliminating austerity. You know, they're going to hire back government workers by the thousands, right? They're going to restore pensions. They're going to raise the minimum wage. All these things are right. That's what they should be doing. And they shouldn't be waiting on any debt deal first before they do that. They should do that first, de facto, and present that as a done deal to the Troika, like it or not. And that's what they're doing. They're severing the connection between austerity programs and debt. And that's the big strategic move by the Greeks, and it's the right one. You know, what the Troika wants is, no, we negotiate first, then we talk about austerity adjustments. You know, they want to flip it on its head. Well, it's been on its head since 2010. But the Greeks say, no, we're going to stand on our feet. We're going to end austerity first, then we'll talk about debt. And by the way, we want to totally restructure the debt-to-GDP-related growth bond swaps. They are in a good position, stronger position, the Greeks, than it appears. And that's the position that the Eurozone cannot afford, given this extreme weak economic condition today, cannot afford to have the Greeks leave the Eurozone. Not because Greece itself is so important, because it will precipitate other moves, possibly, and other debt renegotiation demands, which will happen anyway. You see, it's another big problem. You know, the Troika and the bankers in Europe thought they had this thing all wrapped and put to bed here after 2012, but now it's resurfaced. There's a rebellion. The people are saying no. And even governments, other governments, you know, like Italy and France, you know, not necessarily all that progressive, but they are chafing under the austerity, another austerity rule that says they can't spend more than 3%. Budget deficit. You know, they know they got to spend if they want to get their economies. Italy is in recession. France, they say they're zero growth, stagnant. They're actually in a mild recession, too. They know it. So there's rebellions against austerity in different forms emerging all over Europe, particularly in the periphery, but even in the core now. So in this kind of situation, you know, Eurozone politicians, capitalists, bankers, whatever, they don't have a lot of bargaining power. They can't afford to let this thing of Greece exit happen, because who knows the unknown consequences at a time when the Eurozone is entering deflation, when its economies are slowing down, when you've got all this monetary currency instability going on, when you've got all this political development going with parties on left and right growing rapidly and threatening and actually taking over government, and when you got the problems in Ukraine, and we'll talk about that one too, on the eastern borders, you know, I mean, the Eurozone is a basket case. And if it were strong and growing and so forth, they would be much more adamant with the Greeks. They'd be really putting the screws to them. But it's a good time for the Greeks here to assert themselves and lead, by example, progressive forces, potentially, and new political parties, because the old Social Democratic parties are dead. You know, they're not going anywhere. We're going to see the demise of the center, these center parties. I don't care if you call them social democratic or socialist or whatever. They're none of that. You know, they're just another wing of another kind of a pro-capitalist party. Doesn't matter. In the U.S., that process is going to take a little longer because we don't have a parliamentary system. But there's really no difference between the two wings of the party of corporate America in the U.S. either. But it's harder to get a third party going in the U.S. because long ago they figured out how to prevent the people from exerting their demands and their pressures in a crisis by structuring the government in the U.S. in such a way that it made it very hard. That's what the Constitution was all about, you know. Let's control all these uppity farmers during the revolution and shortly after, who refused to pay to bail out the bondholders in the U.S., you know, and took over the state houses and were refusing. You know, it was almost a revolution going, second revolution in the U.S., and that's why they came up with the Constitution. But that's another story. All right. So the fuse, Greek austerity and debt negotiations going on. The dud. Let's talk about the dud. The dud means, you know, a bomb that didn't go off. You know, it didn't happen, but it could. but it didn't, you see. What's the dud? Again, it's in Europe, and it's the Ukraine. You know, the first IMF bailout for Ukraine occurred last April. $17 billion. We'll recoup, go over that a little bit, so we'll put it in context. But the second one now is announced. Another one, another bailout. And, of course, all this is happening with a backdrop of political crisis. Now, you can't separate out the political crisis from the economic crisis and the IMF bailouts. You know, political crisis was, you know, the battle between the eastern regions, of course, and the western part of Ukraine that came to power here with the February 22nd coup of 2014. You know, that's when, you know, the president, elected president at the time, he was driven out of office and ran away with his tail between his legs. The right wing took over. I mean, really the right wing. These are neo-Nazis. They're Nazis, period. They took over. I mean, that was the, on the street, that's what engineered the coup. We don't still don't know all the details about that, but we do know that on the night before the coup happened, the then president agreed to sit down and agree to a deal with the Europeans. In other words, a trade deal with the Europeans. That was at the center of this conflict that went on for several months before. You know, he refused to negotiate with the... Well, actually, he did negotiate with the Western Europeans on a trade deal, and then he reneged, and then he went and negotiated what he said was a better deal with the Russians, and then the pressure from the street built. You know, they were occupying that square there, Maidan Square, and all the right-wing groups and took over that square and were threatening violence and so forth. We're actually engaging in violence and threatening to take over, occupy the government, and the police were barely holding them off. And then the night before the coup that actually happened, and when Yanushenko ran away, what happened was he sat down and he agreed with the Europeans. But for some reason, someone didn't want that agreement to go through. They wanted a political revolution, not just an economic deepening in relationships to the West. You know, they wanted something even more. So who was they? Who was they? Well, certainly the right wing wanted that major change, but so did the USA. U.S. government wanted to precipitate a regime change, and they did. And they admitted it. You know, Virginia Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State on the street there in Maidan Square, you know, later admitted, didn't know she was being video recorded, that, you know, the U.S. has spent $5 billion on these radical groups, street-level radical groups, and it paid off. NGOs, you know, whatever. That's a big strategy, U.S., when they want to engineer regime change from below. So anyway, you know, the very pro-Western, pro-USA interim government came in into power, and then they had some quick negotiations, and, you know, they put the neo-Nazis in charge of the security services, and then the IMF came in April, and they had a new deal to bail out, $17 billion to bail out the Ukraine. At the time, I was writing articles about this, several articles. You can read them on my website, KikosProductions.com, or my blog, if you want to go back that far, which is just jackrasmus.com. And I was saying that, this IMF deal isn't going to work. $17 billion is nowhere near enough. And I predicted last April that they would need $50 billion at least to bail out the Ukraine. $50 billion. $17 billion was just not going to cut it. In the meantime, the Ukrainian economy, already in recession, was slipping into depression, and I predicted that would continue to deepen throughout 2014, and the currency would continue to free fall, the Ukraine currency, and the central bank would run out of money and foreign exchange reserves, so it wouldn't be able to engage in financing exports. are defending its currency from collapse, you'd get capital flight leaving the country. And the IMF, typical IMF plan, that $17 billion, most of that was earmarked to go to pay for previous loans and current loans. I mean, just this year, 2015, Bloomberg News estimated that $15 billion in payments to the West, to the IMF, to the banks in the West, would have to occur. So what that $17 billion mostly was we're going to give you money so you can pay us back for previous loans. In other words, you're not going to be able to use this much to stimulate your economy. Oh, your central bank can take some of that. They can take some of that to protect the currency, right, and to protect the private banking system in the Ukraine. They can use some of that $17 billion. But, you know, you can't use it to really stimulate the economy. In fact, you know, as with all IMF deals, you're going to have to engage in austerity. And austerity meant, again, as in Greece, for example, and everywhere else, to lay off thousands of government workers, cut wages, cut pensions, and in the case of Ukraine, cut subsidies for gas. You know, it gets pretty cold in Ukraine, and gas is pretty important, and gas comes from Russia. You know, they've been subsidizing up until now those gas payments for folks, households, right? And that's going to end. That's part of austerity. In fact, it just has begun to end here, beginning this year. So that means a big increase in costs for households, which means more less consumption, right? So business investments collapsing and consumption is falling. That means depression. And I predicted it would be at least 10% GDP collapse. And that's depression territory, not recession. You know, prior to that, it was 1 to 2%. Now it's 10%, I predicted. And, you know, the World Bank and IMF forecasts were much more optimistic than that, than mine. But by the end of last year, they had pretty much come around to my forecast. They were predicting 8% as of the third quarter decline in GDP. And things got worse in the fourth quarter, so, you know, it effectively dropped 10%. The economy, which is an amazing collapse of the economy. That is a depression, no doubt. Okay, so at the end of the year, the currency had dropped already 60%, and capital flight was continuing, and things are getting worse. And that's why in September they agreed to try to halt the fighting. The first Minsk-Belarusia meeting in which the parties imposed a kind of a temporary ceasefire, which didn't hold, by the way. Things got worse. You see, they can't put the Ukrainian economy together as long as there's fighting going on. They can't do it. It's not going to work. And the economy got much worse. The ceasefire did not really hold very well. Neither side really wanted the ceasefire. They're all trying to gain more acreage. The Ukrainian army, of course, is not very functional, not doing very well. By the end of the year, the economy is even worse. You know, a good indicator economy is not only the collapse of the currency and GDP, but, you know, another indicator is how much foreign reserves, currency reserves, does the central bank have? Because the central bank has to have those reserves in order to help finance exports and imports. And if it runs out of currency, foreign currency, the country stops exporting, right, or importing semi-finished goods that it needs to continue production. And the economy comes to an even greater halt. And if it does, the real economy, then the banking system collapses. And by, you know, in April, they had about $16 billion in currency reserves, Ukraine. But by the end of the year, they had about five. Enough for maybe a month or two at the most. I mean, this is a real desperate situation. So at the end of last year, you know, the Ukrainian government came to the West, IMF, said, well, this isn't enough money. You know, it's just being recycled to pay your banks and you guys. We need some more money here. We need another $15 billion on top of the $17 billion. Oh, they're getting close to my 50, aren't they? So they went hat in hand to the West, you know, to Brussels and other places, to Washington, And another deal was starting to be put together. But part of the requirement for a new deal in the Ukraine was the West said, you got to allow us to put our managers in charge of your economy. You see, typically the IMF, what it does is say, okay, these are the conditions, this is what you got to do, but it lets the national politicians do it. But in this case, the West, you know, IMF and so forth, don't really trust the new government to be any less corrupt than the old government. So they said, we've got to put our own people in charge here to run this show. We want our own finance minister and our own economics ministers. We want to appoint these people. And Ukraine said, well, wait a minute, they got to be Ukrainians. And they said, well, you know, make them Ukrainians. You know, make an exception to that rule. And what we ended up with was Natalia Jaresko, being the finance minister. Who's Natalia Jaresko? I wrote an article, talked about that. She's the ex-CEO, Chicago CEO of Horizon Capital, shadow bank, private equity firm. Yeah, that's Natalia Jaresko. So we put her, the key point position, in charge of running the Ukrainian economies. And then to let the Europeans have a piece of the action, they put another fellow, a Swedish fellow, I think, who had connections to hedge funds, German hedge funds, Abramovicius or something. Abramovicius, I think his name is. They put him in charge of economics minister, you see. So the Westerners are directly running the Ukraine economy, and that was a prerequisite to giving more money. So they put that in place in December, and now, you know, they've just put together a new package here, a new package to bail out the Ukraine. And this new package is, it varies. It varies, estimates are. It's just coming out, was just announced. But the new package is about, well, it varies. You know, it's the old package was $17 billion with about $10 billion in private money promised. By the way, there's a big U.S. Hedge fund involved, Franklin Templeton, that has a $7 billion exposure to Ukrainian government bonds. Probably one of the reasons why the U.S. has agreed to continue to bail out. You know, to make sure that Franklin Templeton doesn't go under here. But what we've gotten here is about a $17.5 billion four-year deal. In other words, they've renegotiated the debt, you might say. You know, it's important to note that the original $17 billion of last April, only $4.5 billion has been actually distributed after a whole year. And all of that virtually went to pay off Western banks and previous debt and to give some money to the central bank, drill a little bit to the Ukrainian central bank for reasons I described, you know. So they've only distributed $4.5 billion of the previous $17 billion. Now they're going to add $17.5 billion more. So it's about $22 billion. The renegotiated deal here is $22 billion. Now that's the IMF's part of this package. You know, in the first IMF deal, the Westerners didn't put very much. The U.S. only put $1 billion in, and I think there was maybe $1 billion or $2 billion. A promise by the Europeans. Now the IMF isn't going to pony up all the rest additional needed. So now we've got the U.S. and the EU and private interests coming in and adding more bilateral loans and so forth. And some estimate that the package now is about $40 billion when you add the IMF's $22 billion and all the other commitments here, including the U.S. The U.S., by the way, its commitment will be to provide military aid. You know, they're talking about arming the Ukrainian army here with, quote, defensive weapons. Yeah, they'll be defensive, sure. They can call it what they want, but they won't be defensive. So they're going to arm them, and that's what the U.S. is going to provide to the Ukraine, which means Ukraine isn't going to get any money from the U.S. The U.S. government's going to buy money from U.S. arms producers, give them the money, and the arms producers will ship the arms, you see. It's a nice arrangement to give a little pump up here to the defense sector in the U.S. And probably help GDP a little bit in doing that, right? That's going to be slowing down now. Okay, so $40 billion at the top, it looks like. But, you know, you have private investment bankers saying they need $45 billion, and the Federal Financial Times editorial even said $50 billion. Well, you know, they could have saved themselves a lot of time and trouble if they just would have listened to my $50 billion a year ago. So now they're right where I am in terms of my forecast, my prediction. You know, and they're right there with where I am in terms of the GDP impact of all this. In the meantime, investment is dropping 25-30%, construction 15-20%, currency is almost, you know, I think it's more than 80 or 100% now, collapsing. It's a real basket case. And I believe that's why they've come to the table again with Minsk II here, you know. The USA and the EU strategy is to buy time in order to shore up the economy and retool the Ukrainian military. That's why they're willing to agree, and they're pushing Poroshenko, the Ukraine president, to agree to make concessions on autonomy in the eastern regions. But I don't believe they see this as long-term. This is a tactical move on their part. Because the USA's grand strategy, you see, is to provoke a clash with between Western Europe and you know, and its proxy here, which is the Ukraine government, provoke a clash with the eastern regions and therefore Russia. You know, the USA wants Russia to invade directly. Now, Russia has already sent proxies in there, but it hasn't officially crossed borders with official military units, you see. I mean, Putin's cleverly trying to avoid that. And time is on Putin's side because the economy will get worse and worse and worse. And he's waiting for the West and Western Europeans in particular to get tired throwing money down that black hole. When it's got other problems of major significance elsewhere in Western Europe, you know, Greece notwithstanding, deflation notwithstanding, you know, et cetera, recessions, et cetera. Okay, what's this grand strategy? I think the U.S. wants to precipitate a conflict, wants Putin to precipitate a direct conflict, because that way the USA, will be able to pull Germany and Western Europe further away from Russian economic dependence on gas, you see. Europe was getting too cozy with the Russians, not only in terms of gas, but in terms of a lot of other kinds of trades and money flows. And the U.S. doesn't want that. The U.S. wants Europe and Japan and other places to be dependent upon it. And the long-term trend was it would grow less dependent economically. And to sever that growing relationship, economic and political, with Russia, you know, you've got NATO that keeps that at bay, but also start a fight with the Russians and hope that Putin takes the bait and Putin invades. Then it's easy to break off Germany and the rest. You know, it's almost impossible for them not to break off. Now, Putin's strategy is to fight by proxy, no direct invasion. That would play into the hands of U.S. neocons and try to split the Eurozone and keep it neutral. Well, how can it be neutral here? We got sanctions, right, against them, against Russia. Well, the sanctions are not really all that stringent, regardless of what you hear in the press. They're pretty limited, and the Europeans don't want to deepen those sanctions. And they've already figured out private workarounds on those sanctions. You know, the Germans and others are sending these delegations to Russia, business delegations, and you know what they're doing. They're figuring out how can we get around this stuff. And I think they're finding ways of doing that. And Europe just won't go deeper sanctions unless there's a direct invasion by Russia. Then it's going to be hard for them not to go deeper sanctions. But right now, sanctions are kind of frozen in time and degree. Hmm? The German-France strategy is, to talk sanctions and agree to some and work around. Their other strategy is very clearly they don't want NATO to arm Ukraine. The USA wants Ukraine to be armed, rearmed, because they want to provoke a fight, right? They know that if they rearm Ukraine, as Putin has already said, he's not going to allow that to happen. He could invade. Because, bottom line, the Russians are paranoid about putting themselves in a strategic position where they can easily be outflanked. You know, their memory, their historic memory of World War II is too strong. Right? And the engineered collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s and how NATO and George H. Bush had promised NATO would not move east, and it has, of course. So they don't trust the West, and particularly the United States, in that regard. They think the U.S. would probably exert NATO and so forth to force Russia to back off in a whole number of fronts here, and then when they're just trying to restabilize themselves. NATO in the Ukraine is crossing the red line for Putin. And the Germans and French know that, and they don't want to. They're blocking NATO from rearming the Ukraine. Now, the U.S. might just go ahead and do it anyway, because the U.S., they don't really care what, if it's serious enough interest, they don't care what Europe thinks. Right? But this is all part of a bigger game to break, sever relationships between, Russia and Europe. Ukraine is a proxy. It's a pawn in this bigger game. So we'll see. We're sort of like in a interim here, where Germany and France have this trying to maintain some independence in its own policies, and Russia, trying to defend its fundamental interests and not get sucked in to a direct clash. And the U.S. trying to precipitate that. I mean, the U.S. precipitated the coup very clearly. The Europeans were going to get their agreement, their economic agreement, on the 21st of February with the Ukraine, but that wasn't considered good enough, and then the zombies on the street were unleashed, and we know what happened after that, right? So it was a coup. Very clearly, and the elections that followed after that were, most of the country, or a good part of the country, did not even vote in it, so you can't say that's a real stable government and a really representative government, but, that's another question. I'm focusing on the economics of all this. So what we really are facing here in the Ukraine is, one, the Minsk agreement failed, and Minsk, too, ceasefire will fail as well. Both sides are just biding their time. Yeah, and Minsk II will not succeed either. And the IMF II will not succeed either. The second IMF bailout, it's like the first bailout, Greece 2010. The second bailout, Greece 2012. It's the same thing, IMF 1 here last year, IMF 2 here this year. But it's significant the IMF has insisted that the U.S. and Europe and other parties put some skin in the game, put some money up front here. They're not going to put everything up front, They're going to continue. They're $17.5 billion. They're just going to, it's $22 billion because they're going to, restart it, Restart the 17. They've temporarily provided $4.5 billion to pay their banks, Western banks and their loans, make sure they get paid and give some money to the Ukraine Central Bank, but it's not enough and everything's getting worse. So, okay, we're going to write that $4.5 billion off and we're going to be started at $17.5 billion. And yes, we need more than $17.5 billion, and that's therefore USA and EU. You know, you got to each come up with $8 billion more, or $18 billion between you in bilateral loans, whatever those mean, and that's $40 billion. So they're betting on $40 billion, right? And that puts them in a difficult position. You know, the Europeans in a difficult position because, you know, here they are providing, and the IMF providing billions more for the Ukraine, and they're saying to Greece, tough luck, you know, pay up. And Greece is in the Eurozone. You know, Ukraine isn't even in the Eurozone. So, you know, the Greeks are saying, what is this? Well, can't take care of your own at home here, deal with your problems at home, and you're throwing more money over there. Well, the Europeans got sucked into it. They got pulled into it by the U.S. They were happy just to have a trade agreement here on February 21st. They got what they wanted, you know, an economic relationship, deeper economic relationship with the Ukraine. They didn't want regime change. The U.S. wanted regime change, and they got it. And they have... you know, three-fourths of the Ukraine in their pocket. That's a big loss for Russia because it was all neutral before. You know, Russia's trying to carve out, you know, an interest in the eastern and Ukrainian part and, you know, try to, you know, resurrect some of this. But what Russia wants is a neutral Ukraine. Russia doesn't really want Ukraine. They want a Ukraine that's not a NATO Ukraine, that's not totally in the hip pocket of the United States, which it is, of course, you know. Like this guy Yatsenyuk and these guys, you know, they're all trained and educated in the U.S. You know, they're satrapies of the U.S. Now, a satrap was, you know, in ancient times, a kind of a local governor, right, for the Persian king. Right? He did whatever the Persian king wanted. And that's what they are. They're sad. You know, Ukraine's now at least the western part, is a U.S. satrapy economically and politically right now. So, the debt, will it explode again economically? Yeah, it's going to get worse once again. There may be a period of a short stabilization here, but it will get worse. And at a time that Europe cannot afford it to get worse. Europe has big problems of its own. Will Putin fall for the bait, take the bait from the U.S. and invade more directly? Well, only if there's a real NATO move here. And we'll see. We'll see whether he takes that bait because he knows there's a bigger game being played with Western, not all of Europe. And he's trying to balance that. And the U.S. is trying to tip him off of the fence, push him off of the fence and fall for it. So we'll give more money to the Ukraine, and the Europeans who can't afford will give more money to Ukraine, and the crisis will continue to simmer as the economy continues to get weaker. Okay. Jack Rasmus, next week, what we're going to talk about next week is we're going to look at the U.S. economy. We're going to come back home. Is there a real recovery? You know, all this hype about these jobs numbers and so forth, kind of assume there's a real recovery. Well, I'm telling you, there isn't a real recovery, and there are all kind of red lights flashing on the horizon here in the U.S. economy. Manufacturing, biggest slowdown. Retail sales here, slowdown. You know, the collapse of the shale and industrial production. Okay, we'll talk about that next week, so tune in. And has the U.S. economy really recovered, and will it continue or not? Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.